A strange, low-grade sort of desire it must be, to be spread out over every day of the year, and never to know the choice of sex. But there it is, and here am I. Tonight, my extreme physical awareness of him was rather hard to ignore, and I was too tired to divert it into untrance or any other channel of the discipline. Finally, he asked, had he offended me? I explained my silence with some embarrassment. I was afraid he would laugh at me. After all, he is no more an oddity, a sexual freak, than I am. Up here on the ice, each of us is singular, isolate. I, as cut off from those like me, from my society and its rules, as he from his. There is no world full of other Githenians here to explain and support my existence. We are equals at last. Equal. Alien. Alone. He did not laugh, of course. Rather, he spoke with a gentleness that I did not know was in him. After a while, he too came to speak of isolation, of loneliness. Your race is appallingly alone in its world. No other mammalian species, no other ambisexual species, no animal intelligent enough even to domesticate as pets. It must color your thinking, this uniqueness. I don't mean scientific thinking only, though you are extraordinary hypothesizers. It's extraordinary that you arrived at any concept of evolution, faced with that unbridgeable gap between yourselves and the lower animals. But philosophically, emotionally, to be so solitary, in so hostile a world, it must affect your entire outlook. The Omeshta would say that man's singularity is his divinity. Lords of the earth, yes. Other cults on other worlds have come to the same conclusion. They tend to be the cults of dynamic, aggressive, ecology-breaking cultures. Orgrin is in the pattern, in its way. At least they seem bent on pushing things around. What do the Handarata say? Well, in the Handara, you know, there's no theory, no dogma. Maybe they are less aware of the gap between men and beasts, being more occupied with the likenesses, the links, the whole of which living things are a part. Tormer's lay had been all day in my mind, and I said the words, light is the left hand of darkness, and darkness the right hand of light. Two are one. Life and death, lying together like lovers in Kemmer, like hands joined together, like the end and the way. My voice shook as I said the lines, for I remembered as I said them that in the letter my brother wrote me before his death, he had quoted the same words. I brooded, and after some time he said, you're isolated and undivided. Perhaps you are as obsessed with wholeness as we are with dualism. We are dualists, too. Duality is an essential, isn't it? So long as there is myself and the other. I and thou, he said. Yes, it does, after all, go even wider than sex. Tell me, how does the other sex of your race differ from yours? He looked startled, and in fact my question rather startled me. Kemmer brings out these spontaneities in one. We were both self-conscious. I never thought of that, he said. You've never seen a woman. He used his Terran language word, which I knew. I saw your pictures of them. The women looked like pregnant Githenians, but with larger breasts. Do they differ much from your sex in mind behavior? Are they like a different species? No. Yes. No, of course not. Not really. But the difference is very important. I suppose the most important thing, the heaviest single factor in one's life, is whether one's born male or female. In most societies, it determines one's expectations, activities, outlook, ethics, manners, almost everything. Vocabulary, semiotic usages, clothing, even food. Women, Women tend to eat less. It's extremely hard to separate the innate differences from the learned ones. Even where women participate equally with men in the society, they still, after all, do all the childbearing, and so most of the child-rearing. Equality is not the general rule, then. Are they mentally inferior? I don't know. They don't often seem to turn up mathematicians or composers of music or inventors or abstract thinkers. But it isn't that they're stupid. Physically, they're less muscular but a little more durable than men. Psychologically, after he had stared a long time at the glowing stove, he shook his head. "Hearth," he said, "I can't tell you what women are like. I never thought about it much in the abstract, you know, and God, by now I've practically forgotten. I've been here 2 years." "You don't know. In a sense, women are more alien to me than you are. With you, I share one sex, anyhow." He looked away and laughed, rueful and uneasy. My own feelings were complex, and we let the matter drop. Ernie Thonern. 18 miles today, east-northeast, by compass, on skis. We got clear of the pressure ridges and crevasses in the first hour of pulling. Both got in harness, I ahead at first with the probe, but no more need for testing. The fern is a couple of feet thick over solid ice, and on the fern lie several inches of sound new snow from the last fall, with a good surface. Neither we nor the sledge broke through at all, and the sledge pulled so light that it was hard to believe we're still hauling about 100 pounds apiece. During the afternoon we took turns hauling, as one can do it easily on this splendid surface. It is a pity that all the hard work uphill and over rock came while the load was heavy. Now we go light. Too light. I find myself thinking about food a good deal. We eat, I says, ethereally. All day we went light and fast over the level ice plain, dead white, under a gray-blue sky, unbroken except for the few black Nunatak peaks now far behind us, and a smudge of darkness. Drumner's breath behind them. Nothing else, the veiled sun, the ice. Chapter 17. An Argotta Creation Myth. The origins of this myth are prehistorical. It has been recorded in many forms. This very primitive version is from a pre-Yomish written text found in the Issenpeth cave shrine of the Gobrin hinterlands. In the beginning, there was nothing but ice and the sun. Over many years, the sun shining melted a great crevasse in the ice. In the sides of this crevasse were great shapes of ice, and there was no bottom to it. Drops of water melted from the ice shapes in the sides of the chasm and fell down and down. One of the ice shapes said, "I bleed." Another of the ice shapes said, "I weep." A third one said, "I sweat." The ice shapes climbed up out of the abyss and stood on the plain of ice. He that said, "I bleed," he reached up to the sun and pulled out handfuls of excrement from the bowels of the sun, and with that dung made the hills and valleys of the earth. He that said, "I weep," he breathed on the ice, and melting it, made the seas and the rivers. He that said, "I sweat," he gathered up soil and seawater, and with them made trees, plants, herbs, and grains of the field, animals, and men. The plants grew in the soil and the sea, the beasts ran on the land and swam in the sea, but the men did not wake. 39 of them there were. They slept on the ice and would not move. Then the three ice shapes stooped down and sat with their knees drawn up and let the sun melt them. As milk they melted, and the milk ran into the mouths of the sleepers, and the sleepers woke. That milk is drunk by the children of men alone, and without it they will not wake to life. The first to wake up was Idandarith. So tall was he that when he stood up, his head split the sky and snow fell down. He saw the others stirring and awakening, and was afraid of them when they moved, so he killed one after another with a blow of his fist. 36 of them he killed, but one of them, the next to last one, ran away. Haharith he was called. Far he ran over the plain of ice and over the lands of earth. Idandarith ran behind him, and caught up with him at last, and smote him. Haharith died. Then Idandarith returned to the birthplace on the Gobrin ice, where the bodies of the others lay. But the last one was gone. He had escaped while Idandarith pursued Haharith. Idandarith built a house of the frozen bodies of his brothers, and waited there inside that house for that last one to come back. Each day one of the corpses would speak, saying, "Does he burn? Does he burn?" All the other corpses would say with frozen tongues, "No, no." Then Idandarith entered Kemmer as he slept, and moved and spoke aloud in dreams, and when he woke, the corpses were all saying, "He burns, he burns." And the last brother, the youngest one, heard them saying that, and came into the house of bodies, and there coupled with Idandarith. Of these two were the nations of men born, out of the flesh of Idandarith, out of Idandarith's womb. The name of the other, the younger brother, the father, his name is not known. Each of the children born to them had a piece of darkness that followed him about wherever he went by daylight. Idandarith said, "Why are my sons followed thus by darkness?" His Kemmering said, "Because they were born in the house of flesh. Therefore death follows at their heels. They are in the middle of time. In the beginning there was sun and the ice, and there was no shadow. In the end, when we are done, the sun will devour itself, and shadow will eat light, and there will be nothing left but the ice and the darkness." Chapter 18, On the Ice. Sometimes, as I'm falling asleep in a dark, quiet room, I have for a moment a great and treasurable illusion of the past. The wall of a tent leans up over my face, not visible but audible, a slanting plane of faint sound. The susurrus of blown snow. Nothing can be seen. The light emission of the chobby stove is cut off, and it exists only as a sphere of heat, a heart of warmth. The faint dampness and confining cling of my sleeping bag. The sound of the snow. Barely audible Estrovan's breathing as he sleeps. Darkness. Nothing else. We are inside, the two of us, in shelter, at rest, at the center of all things. Outside, as always, lies the great darkness, the cold, death solitude. In such fortunate moments as I fall asleep, I know beyond doubt what the real center of my own life is, that time, which is past and lost and yet is permanent, the enduring moment, the heart of warmth. I'm not trying to say that I was happy during those weeks of hauling a sledge across an ice sheet in the dead of winter. I was hungry, overstrained and often anxious. And it all got worse the longer it went on. I certainly wasn't happy. Happiness has to do with reason, and only reason earns it. What I was given was the thing you can't earn, and can't keep, and often don't even recognize at the time. I mean joy. I always woke up first, usually before daylight. My metabolic rate is slightly over the Gathenian norm, as are my height and weight. Estrovan had figured these differences into the food ration calculations in his scrupulous way, which one could see as either housewifely or scientific. And from the start, I had had a couple of ounces more food per day than he. Protests of injustice fell silent before the self-evident justice of this unequal division. However divided, the share was small. I was hungry, constantly hungry, daily hungrier. I woke up because I was hungry. If it was still dark, I turned up the light of the chabi stove and put a pan of ice, brought in the night before, now thawed, on the stove to boil. Estrovan, meanwhile, engaged in his customary fierce and silent struggle with sleep, as if he wrestled with an angel. Winning, he sat up, stared at me vaguely, shook his head, and woke. By the time we were dressed and booted and had the bags rolled up, breakfast was ready. A mug of boiling hot orsh and one cube of gichi-michi expanded by hot water into a sort of small, doughy bun. We chewed slowly, solemnly retrieving all dropped crumbs. The stove cooled as we ate. We packed it up with the pan and mugs, pulled on our hooded overcoats and our mittens, and crawled out into the open air. The coldness of it was perpetually incredible. Every morning I had to believe it all over again. If one had been outside to relieve oneself already, the second exit was only harder. Sometimes it was snowing. Sometimes the long light of early day lay wonderfully gold and blue across the miles of ice. Most often it was gray. We brought the thermometer into the tent with us nights, and when we took it outside, it was interesting to watch the pointer swing to the right, Gathenian dials read counterclockwise, almost too fast to follow, registering a drop of 20, 50, 80 degrees, till it stopped somewhere between 0 and 60 below. One of us collapsed the tent and folded it, while the other loaded stove, bags, and so forth onto the sledge. The tent was strapped over all, and we were ready for skis and harness. Little metal was used in our straps and fittings, but the harnesses had buckles of aluminum alloy, too fine to fasten with mittens on, which burned in that cold exactly as if they were red hot. I had to be very careful of my fingers when the temperature was below minus 20, especially if the wind blew, for I could pick up a frostbite amazingly fast. My feet never suffered, and that is a factor of major importance in a winter journey where an hour's exposure can, after all, cripple one for a week, or for life. Estrovan had had to guess my size, and the snow boots he got me were a little large, but extra socks filled the discrepancy. We put on our skis, got into harness as quick as possible, bucked and pried and jolted the sledge free if its runners were frozen in, and set off. Mornings after heavy snowfall, we might have to spend some while digging out the tent and sledge before we could set off. The new snow was not hard to shovel away, though it made great impressive drifts around us, who were, after all, the only impediment for hundreds of miles, the only thing sticking out above the ice. We pulled eastward by the compass. The usual direction of the wind was north to south, off the glacier. Day after day it blew from our left as we went. The hood did not suffice against that wind, and I wore a facial mask to protect my nose and left cheek. Even so, my left eye froze shut one day, and I thought I had lost the use of it. Even when Estrovan thawed it open with breath and tongue, I could not see with it for some while, so probably more had been frozen than the lashes. In sunlight, both of us wore the Gathenian slit-screen eye shields, and neither of us suffered any snow blindness. We had small opportunity. The ice, as Estevan had said, tends to hold a high-pressure zone above its central area, where thousands of square miles of white reflect the sunlight. We were not in this central zone, however, but at best on the edge of it, between it and the zone of turbulent, deflected, precipitation-laden storms that it sends continually to torment the subglacial lands. Winds from due north brought bare, bright weather, but from northeast or northwest it brought snow, or harrowed up dry fallen snow into blinding, biting clouds like sand or dust storms. Or else, sinking almost to nothing, crept in sinuous trails along the surface, leaving the sky white, the air white, no visible sun, no shadow, and the snow itself, the ice, disappeared from under our feet. Around midday we would halt, and cut and set up a few blocks of ice for a protective wall if the wind was strong. We heated water to soak a cube of gitchy-mitchy in, and drink the water hot, sometimes with a bit of sugar melted in it. Harnessed up again and went on. We seldom talked while on the march, or at lunch, for our lips were sore, and when one's mouth was open the cold got inside, hurting teeth and throat and lungs. It was necessary to keep the mouth closed and breathe through the nose, at least when the air was 40 or 50 degrees below freezing. When it went on lower than that, the whole breathing process was further complicated by the rapid freezing of one's exhaled breath. If you didn't look out, your nostrils might freeze shut. And then, to keep from suffocating, you would gasp in a lungful of razors. Under certain conditions, our exhalations, freezing instantly, made a tiny cracking noise, like distant firecrackers, and a shower of crystals. Each breath, a snowstorm. We pulled till we were tired out, or till it began to grow dark, halted, set up the tent, pegged down the sledge if there was threat of high wind, and settled in for the night. On a usual day, we would have pulled for 11 or 12 hours and made between 12 and 18 miles. It does not seem a very good rate, but then conditions were a bit adverse. The crust of the snow was seldom right for both skis and sledge runners. When it was light and new, the sledge ran through rather than over it. When it was partly hardened, the sledge would stick, but we on skis would not, which meant that we were perpetually being pulled up backward with a jolt. And when it was hard, it was often heaped up in long wind waves, sastrugi, that in some places ran up to 4 feet high. We had to haul the sledge up and over each knife-edged or fantastically corniced top, then slide her down, and up over the next one, for they never seemed to run parallel to our course. I had imagined the Gobrin ice plateau to be all one sheet, like a frozen pond, but there were hundreds of miles of it that were rather like an abruptly frozen, storm-raised sea. The business of setting up camp, making everything secure, getting all the clinging snow off one's outer clothing and so on, was trying. Sometimes it did not seem worthwhile. It was so late, so cold, one was so tired, that it would be much easier to lie down in a sleeping bag in the lee of the sledge and not bother with the tent. I remember how clear this was to me on certain evenings, and how bitterly I resented my companion's methodical, tyrannical insistence that we do everything and do it correctly and thoroughly. I hated him at such times, with a hatred that rose straight up out of the death that lay within my spirit. I hated the harsh, intricate, obstinate demands that he made on me in the name of life. When all was done, we could enter the tent, and almost at once the heat of the chabi stove could be felt as an enveloping, protecting ambience. A marvelous thing surrounded us. Warmth. Death and cold were elsewhere. Outside. Hatred was also left outside. We ate and drank. After we ate, we talked. When the cold was extreme, even the excellent insulation of the tent could not keep it out, and we lay in our bags as close to the stove as possible. A little fur of frost gathered on the inner surface of the tent. To open the valve was to let in a draft of cold that instantly condensed, filling the tent with a swirling mist of fine snow. When there was blizzard, needles of icy air blew in through the vents, elaborately protected as they were, and an impalpable dust of snow motes fogged the air. On those nights, the storm made an incredible noise, and we could not converse by voice unless we shouted with our heads together. On other nights, it was still, with such a stillness as one imagines as existing before the stars began to form, or after everything has perished. Within an hour after our evening meal, Estevan turned the stove down, if it was feasible to do so, and turned the light emission off. As he did so, he murmured a short and charming grace of invocation, the only ritual words I had ever learned of the Handara. "Praise then darkness and creation unfinished," he said, and there was darkness. We slept. In the morning, it was all to do over. We did it over for 50 days. Estevan kept up his journal, though during the weeks on the ice he seldom wrote more than a note of the weather and the distance we had come that day. Among these notes there is occasional mention of his own thoughts or of some of our conversation, but not a word concerning the profounder conversation between us, which occupied our rest between dinner and sleep on many nights of the first month on the ice, while we still had enough energy to talk, and on certain days that we spent stormbound in the tent. I told him that I was not forbidden, but not expected, to use paraverbal speech on a non-ally planet, and asked him to keep what he learned from his own people, at least until I could discuss what I had done with my colleagues on the ship. He assented and kept his word. He never said or wrote anything concerning our silent conversations. Mind speech was the only thing I had to give Estevan, out of all my civilization. My alien reality in which he was so profoundly interested, I could talk and describe endlessly, but that was all I had to give. Indeed, it may be the only important thing we have to give to Winter. But I can't say that gratitude was my motive for infringing on the law of cultural embargo. I was not paying my debt to him. Such debts remain owing. Estevan and I had simply arrived at the point where we shared whatever we had that was worth sharing. I expect it will turn out that sexual intercourse is possible between Gathenian double-sexed and Heinisch norm one-sexed human beings, though such intercourse will inevitably be sterile. It remains to be proved. Estevan and I proved nothing except perhaps a rather subtler point. The nearest to crisis that our sexual desires brought us was on a night early in the journey, our second night up on the ice. We had spent all day struggling and backtracking in the cut-up, crevassed area east of the Fire Hills. We were tired that evening, but elated, sure that a clear course would soon open out ahead. But after dinner, Estevan grew taciturn and cut my talk off short. I said at last, after a direct rebuff, "Harth, I've said something wrong again. Please tell me what it is." He was silent. "I've made some mistake in Shifgathor. I'm sorry. I can't learn. I've never even really understood the meaning of the word." "Shifgathor? It comes from an old word for shadow." We were both silent for a little, and then he looked at me with a direct, gentle gaze. His face in the reddish light was as soft, as vulnerable, as remote, as the face of a woman who looks at you out of her thoughts and does not speak. And I saw then again, and for good, what I had always been afraid to see, and had pretended not to see in him, that he was a woman as well as a man. Any need to explain the sources of that fear vanished with the fear. What I was left with was, at last, acceptance of him as he was. Until then I had rejected him, refused him his own reality. He had been quite right to say that he, the only person on Gethen who trusted me, was the only Gethenian I distrusted. For he was the only one who had entirely accepted me as a human being, who had liked me personally and given me entire personal loyalty, and who therefore had demanded of me an equal degree of recognition, of acceptance. I had not been willing to give it. I had been afraid to give it. I had not wanted to give my trust, my friendship, to a man who was a woman. A woman who was a man. He explained, stiffly and simply, that he was in Kemmer, and had been trying to avoid me, insofar as one of us could avoid the other. "I must not touch you," he said, with extreme constraint. Saying that, he looked away. I said, "I understand. I agree completely." For it seemed to me, and I think to him, that it was from that sexual tension between us, admitted now and understood but not assuaged, that the great and sudden assurance of friendship between us rose. A friendship so much needed by us both in our exile, and already so well proved in the days and nights of our bitter journey, that it might as well be called, now as later, love. But it was from the difference between us, not from the affinities and likenesses, but from the difference, that the love came. And it was itself the bridge, the only bridge across what divided us. For us to meet sexually would be for us to meet once more as aliens. We had touched in the only way we could touch. We left it at that. I do not know if we were right. We talked some more that night, and I recall being very hard put to it to answer coherently when he asked me what women were like. We were both rather stiff and cautious with each other for the next couple of days. A profound love between two people involves, after all, the power and chance of doing profound hurt. It would never have occurred to me before that night that I could hurt Estevan. Now that the barriers were down, the limitation in my terms of our converse and understanding seemed intolerable to me. Quite soon, two or three nights later, I said to my companion as we finished our dinner, a special treat, sugared kadik-like porridge, to celebrate a 20-mile run. "Last spring, that night in the corner red dwelling, you said you wished I'd tell you more about paraverbal speech." "Yes, I did." "Do you want to see if I can teach you how to speak it?" He laughed. "You want to catch me lying?" "If you ever lied to me, it was long ago and in another country." He was an honest person, but rarely a direct one. That tickled him, and he said, "In another country, I may tell you other lies, but I thought you were forbidden to teach your mind science to the natives until we join the Ecumen." "Not forbidden. It's not done. I'll do it, though, if you like, and if I can. I'm no educer." "There are special teachers of the skill?" "Yes. Not on Altera, where there's a high occurrence of natural sensitivity, and they say mothers mind speak to their unborn babies. I don't know what the babies answer. But most of us have to be taught, as if it were a foreign language, or rather as if it were our native language, but learned very late." I think he understood my motive in offering to teach him the skill, and he wanted very much to learn it. We had a go at it. I recalled what I could of how I had been educed at age 12. I told him to clear his mind, let it be dark. This he did, no doubt more promptly and thoroughly than I ever had done. He was an adept of the Handara, after all. Then I mind spoke to him as clearly as I could. No result. We tried it again. Since one cannot bespeak until one has been bespoken, until the telepathic potentiality has been sensitized by one clear reception, I had to get through to him first. I tried for half an hour, till I felt hoarse of brain. He looked crestfallen. "I thought it would be easy for me," he confessed. We were both tired out and called the attempt off for the night. Our next efforts were no more successful. I tried sending to Estravan while he slept, recalling what my educer had told me about the occurrence of dream messages among pre-telepathic peoples. But it did not work. "Perhaps my species lacks the capacity," he said. "We have enough rumors and hints to have made up a word for the power, but I don't know of any proven instances of telepathy among us." So it was with my people for thousands of years. A few natural sensitives, not comprehending their gift and lacking anyone to receive from or send to. All the rest latent, if that. You know, I told you that, except in the case of the born sensitive, the capacity, though it has a physiological basis, is a psychological one, a product of culture, a side effect of the use of the mind. Young children and defectives and members of unevolved or regressed societies can't mind speak. The mind must exist on a certain plane of complexity first. You can't build up amino acids out of hydrogen atoms. A good deal of complexifying has to take place first. The same situation. Abstract thought, varied social interaction, intricate cultural adjustments, aesthetic and ethical perception. All of it has to reach a certain level before the connections can be made, before the potentiality can be touched at all. Perhaps we Gathinians haven't attained that level. You're far beyond it. But luck is involved, as in the creation of amino acids, or to take analogies on the cultural plane, only analogies, but they illuminate, the scientific method, for instance, the use of concrete experimental techniques in science. There are peoples of the Ecumen who possess a high culture, a complex society, philosophies, arts, ethics, a high style and a great achievement in all those fields. And yet, they have never learned to weigh a stone accurately. They can learn how, of course. Only for 500,000 years they never did. There are peoples who have no higher mathematics at all, nothing beyond the simplest applied arithmetic. Every one of them is capable of understanding the calculus, but not one of them does, or ever has. As a matter of fact, my own people, the Terrans, were ignorant until about 3,000 years ago of the uses of zero. That made Estravan blink. As for Gethin, what I'm curious about is whether the rest of us may find ourselves to have the capacity for foretelling, whether this, too, is a part of the evolution of the mind, if you'll teach us the techniques. You think it a useful accomplishment? Accurate prophecy? Well, of course. You might have to come to believe that it's a useless one in order to practice it. Your Handara fascinates me, Harf, but now and then I wonder if it isn't simply paradox developed into a way of life. We tried mind speech again. I had never before sent repeatedly to a total non-receiver. The experience was disagreeable. I began to feel like an atheist praying. Presently, Estravan yawned and said, "I am deaf, deaf as a rock. We'd better sleep." I assented. He turned out the light, murmuring his brief praise of darkness. We burrowed down into our bags, and within a minute or two he was sliding into sleep as a swimmer slides into dark water. I felt his sleep as if it were my own. The emphatic bond was there, and once more I bespoke him sleepily by his name. "Theram?" He sat bolt upright, for his voice rang out above me in the blackness, loud. "Arik, is that you?" "No, Genli I, I am bespeaking you. His breath caught. Silence. He fumbled with the chobby stove, turned up the light, stared at me with his dark eyes full of fear. I dreamed, he said. I thought I was at home. You heard me mind speak. You called me. It was my brother. It was his voice I heard. He's dead. You called me. You called me Theram. This is more terrible than I had thought. He shook his head as a man will do to shake off nightmare, and then put his face in his hands. Harth, I'm very sorry. No, call me by name. If you can speak inside my skull with the dead man's voice, then you can call me by my name. Would he have called me Harth? Oh, I see why there's no lying in this mind speech. It is a terrible thing. All right. All right, speak to me again. Wait. No, go on. With his fierce, frightened gaze on me, I bespoke him. Theram, my friend, there's nothing to fear between us. He kept on staring at me, so that I thought he had not understood, but he had. Ah, but there is, he said. After a while, controlling himself, he said calmly, You spoke in my language. Well, you don't know mine.